Welcome to episode 38 of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast, back with another high-quality episode. Brian, let's start off talking about law firms.
Thanks, Tucker. So a couple interesting pieces of information that came out over the last couple of weeks. The first out of CoStar, and unfortunately we don't have it displayed, but the title is Office Landlords Prefer These Types of Tenants. Subheading, property owners benefit from longer lease terms, willingness to pay higher rents. Willingness to pay higher rents. I'm not sure if they're willing. They just end up paying higher rents for a number of reasons that we can get into on the pod here. But what they're talking about is law firms. The chart shows that out of kind of five classes of firms, financial services, law firms, consulting firms, tech firms, and media companies, law firms pay the second highest average rent. But have the longest average lease terms, which on average are 8 years. I would tell you that the smaller firms probably skew that 8 down, and it's not really telling the story. If you're, you know, if you're a full floor law firm or larger, you're probably signing a 10-year lease, and many of them, the larger ones, are signing 15-year leases, which are somewhat unheard of in, you know, in the industry across all sectors today. So. CoStar had, you know, which is a property database really geared towards landlords that's really paid for by brokerage companies, but a lot of landlords as well, is coming out and kind of saying the quiet part out loud, saying that law firms effectively pay more and sign longer leases, so landlords love them. So what I wanted to talk about here today was why is that, and how do you change the narrative? And I think the reason is the same reasons it was before COVID, before the change in work strategy, which is law firms build very expensive space. It's you know, it was the age of mahogany and lots of private offices, now to a much cleaner, less exposed wood look, but it's still a very expensive build out, a lot of private offices and heavy infrastructure within the space, which makes it very, very expensive to move. I mean, it's not uncommon in here in Boston to have the costs over, you know, well over $300 a foot, could be $500 a foot all in for some firms I've heard, right? More, probably 300 to 400 is the number. And that's just very expensive. So the average law firm, we did a study a number of years ago, the average law firm was in their space 20 years or longer, right? So landlords know this. And in those renewals, they're allowed to charge those tenants more money. In a face in an age of where there's very high availability, very high vacancy, and a lot of uncertainty around tenants' use of space, companies or landlords are looking at the marketplace and all the different companies they can lease to and really focusing on law firms. And that was the first article that came out, and I'll pause there for anyone's thoughts.
Can I chime in again? I must have said this previously on the pod, but I'm going to say it again now. It's this idea that, you know, not only law firms, but lease renewals generally are just crazy. Like, how is it that commercial real estate is the only industry I know where long-term loyal repeat customers are expected to pay a premium, right? A loyalty premium, because, you know, 9 times out of 10, the tenant doesn't want to move, and 10 times out of 10, the landlord knows exactly that. So lease renewals are some of the most interesting assignments. And what you're describing about law firms suggests to me that they are the most challenging lease renewal assignments, and maybe the most in need of an important tenant side broker partner.
Good point, John. Yeah, I think right now law firms are going through somewhat of a renaissance in terms of how they look at space. And that's kind of the other side of this is I saw a study from Nelson that I thought was really interesting on kind of top five trends, which I think the more that a law firm can start to tell the narrative coming into, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ahead of 2 years ahead of their lease expiration, start to tell a narrative on how their space works for them, how they want to reimagine their space, and really start to build a strategy and communication into the landlord, into the marketplace, and be able to, even if they do want to renew, be able to tell a story that, and be properly represented, but it's really about the story, is be able to show that the space doesn't meet who they want to be and who they envision themselves from a strategy perspective going forward. And they would require a lot of capital. They would require a lot of pain to be able to remain in this location, right? So I know I was working with one, and it was one of the best lines I've ever heard in a meeting. I was with the director of real estate, and we came in to meet with their landlord, I think with Brookfield. And he sat down, and we started talking, and he said, you know, I just want to let you know, it's more expensive for me, from a capital perspective, it's more expensive for me to stay in this space. The landlord's like, well, what do you mean? It's like, well, I've got to do the work here in four phases. I've got to move people around 2-3 times. There's an opportunity cost to the work that they're doing because they have to move and there's disruption. Two, we can't do it as one single project that like we could at another building. So it's really actually more expensive for me to stay in your building. I just wanted you to know that in terms of how this negotiation plays out. And it was just a really powerful statement because it was true, because if they were going to stay in the building, they were going to do a complete gut overhaul, right? And two, the landlord was looking at the situation entirely different and it put them on their heels. And the client had enough credibility. He was a professional in the business. They knew that they had done their homework. The company was a large national law firm, had the capital to move. You know, a lot of firms don't have the capital and they try to play the game, and that's a different strategy altogether. And it's one you can overcome, but it's more difficult. But it was just a great message to set the table to start the negotiations that it was more expensive to stay in his building, where the landlord's thinking, well, there's a highly likelihood 80-90% they stay because it's more expensive to move.
I think this whole study and all the data around law firms paying the highest rents and having the longest term leases is kind of interesting because having worked with lots of law firms, we all know that those managing partners or firm administrators or whoever it is, I would be really irritated about this, right? Particularly being the best kind of tenant that a landlord can have in terms of, long, steady, generally predictable, generally pretty recession resistant as a, business services type company. Yeah, they're paying the highest rents. And it really gets you thinking about what other industry types are paying these really high rents without even realizing it. Like, I bet if you ask the average law firm, maybe not, like a AM50, but like just the average law firm, whether it be 10,000 feet or 40,000 foot local firm or whoever it is, and you said, hey, do you think that you are getting, on average, better deals than market? Probably all of them would say, oh, 100%. We're getting significantly better deals than market. You know, we have a great relationship with our landlord. We're, really big, credible law firm. Meanwhile, this is the worst performing cohort of tenants, period. They have no idea, which is kind of ironic given who we're talking about.
I love the way you put that. It's true. And I think that's why this article is interesting and great for, people that sit in our chairs to be able to educate the marketplace on how landlords think about them. Because you're right. I think the narrative has always been the other way, that they think, given to John's point earlier, the quality of their tenancy, the predictability of their tenancy, the way they invest in the landlord's building with amazing space, that's going to translate to them being considered of value and therefore lower cost, where they're considered an anchor, so we can charge you more. So it's a complete reversal of exactly what probably a lot of people think.
Well, and not to mention, law firms are overwhelmingly the number one in office industry right now in commercial real estate. So why does that matter? Landlords are trying to activate their buildings. When you come tour one of the buildings with a prospective tenant, no matter what industry they might be, what do landlords want you to experience? They want you to experience activation. They want you to feel like this building is alive, that there are people coming to work. Because if you see people in the lobby or at the coffee shop or at the Starbucks, whatever it might be in the lobby, it suggests to you that this is a place where people want to be versus work from home. So for those that need office space, that are out looking for space, it helps to have law firms in your building because odds are, your building will be more populated with people on a daily basis than a building that is occupied by, say, tech. And the statistics don't lie. I mean, law firms are back on average across the country, depending on what market you look at, give or take 60 to 70% of the time of the 5 days a week, whereas the general office market is more like 50%. So it's a meaningful difference. And so, you know, that's one other reason, albeit not financially related, landlords depend on law firms, especially right now.
Yeah. So, changing gears, there was this really interesting study that Nelson, the architectural firm, came out with around trends in law firms. And this is one I thought would be really interesting to kind of walk through real quickly. But the first trend they found as they looked across close to 2 million square feet of law firm space that they've built for clients nationally, the first is this formalized flexibility. And it's interesting, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong here, but a lot of these trends are in mainstream for other industries, probably well before they became mainstream for law firms. But because of the industry and how they've kind of anchored around their strategy and how they anchor around their space differently historically, these trends are just coming into the law firm industry that probably have been around other industries longer. So bear with me. But the first is kind of formalized flexibility with hybrid work. Even lawyers take work from home days too. They've kind of formalized that process in the law firms. They've gotten unassigned offices for certain partners that don't want to be there, or certain associates or partners that don't want to be there every day. They've looked at doubling up offices. They've looked at some sort of a way to be more formal about creating flexibility in the space. Second is this age of individuality. So instead of focusing...
Hold on, Brian. You moved too fast from that first one. Formalized flexibility. Think about it in particular for a law firm where the attorneys are going to have paralegals. So are they not coming in when the attorneys are not coming in? Like, are you coordinating all of that? And then also think about junior attorneys, associates who are in office. And if the partners and the senior partners aren't in office, there's no mixing, there's no learning. Like, what a classic example of the value of being in person to operate as part of a team. And to be, you, if your paralegals are in and you're not, that's really going to have an impact on the culture of the organization. And the cross-pollinization learning by having the junior associates there while the senior partners are there and trying to coordinate. If somebody's staying away, we're missing all of that mixing opportunity. So yeah, formalizing flexibility. But I think they are poster children for the folks who really benefit from being in person.
Yeah, and I think the point isn't that flexibility means you're not in the office. It means we need to create an office that has a different environment for our people that are working differently. So you could still be there 4 days a week, but a lot of the staff, the paralegal staff, a lot of the administrative staff, they're the ones who are kind of demanding to be out of the office more, right? Or another thing in the article was around a hub and spoke. Some firms are saying, you know what? We're not going to have our one large location downtown and make everyone commute in. We're going to have a smaller central hub in a city and then push out more spokes into different areas where people and lawyers are into the neighborhoods or into the suburbs, I should say. So the just having a strategy rather than just say, you know what, we're going to build one big office and everyone has to come here every day. Now it's like, okay, we need to formalize some level of flexibility and we need to have a policy around it and we need to lean into it is the trend that I think they're describing. The second one, which is pretty interesting, is like this age of individuality. So each firm historically, for anyone who doesn't know, that the industry really likes to keep benchmarks against each other. Right. So one of the things that they found is that firms are now more focusing internally. How do we become better at who we are rather than compare ourselves to other firms? So it's this individual focus rather than an industry focus is an interesting one. And I think part of that is and it leads into the third and the fourth, is it they're trying to use more a hospitality focus and more these law firms are coming, the lobbies are becoming more of like the lobby of a hotel or the lobby of an airport that has amenities and places to break off and things you can do that are not traditional law firm focused, right? So how do you become the culture of who we are rather than compare ourselves to others in the industry? Third is an entertainment forward approach. So building more entertainment space into the, and this isn't amenities. Amenities is the fourth one. Entertainment meaning like large meeting spaces into their offices, which I found is interesting because a lot of firms are going away from this, not building the 200-person auditorium in their space because they're going to go rent it somewhere else. They found a trend where law firms are starting to actually build that into the space, which I thought was really interesting. It's not cost-effective, but it's important enough that they made it one of their top five trends for the industry, which I thought was interesting. Fourth was around amenities, and that's another one they're borrowing from other industries. And how do we bring more amenities to our space? If we are, you know, if we are building space, what does that mean? How does it look? How does it feel? And how do we, how do we borrow, I think, from other industries to more amenitize our space and make it a desirable place for people to show up? And the fifth is technology. Right. Another thing to borrowing from other industries. How do we enhance our space with technology to get it performing at a higher rate than it was previously? So I thought those, you know, a lot of those are kind of repeated from industry to industry. But for the law firms that are traditionally very slow to adapt to changing environments in the workplace, I thought that was pretty interesting to bring up.
On the technology front, I got a question for you all. I had somebody mention to me the idea of an always-on Zoom room. Have you guys run across this, where you don't need to log on? It's just a conference room that's always on, and somehow you log into it, and you skip the whole log-on phase? Anyone else heard of that? Sounds kind of interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's funny. The article actually, the thing said, we're not talking about Zoom rooms. We're talking... we're talking about better connectivity, better acoustics, better lighting, better furniture, designing upgraded spaces that that have one-touch connectivity, so you are effectively always connected, but you don't need to log in and connect the way you would. I know I was at a financial services firm recently touring their space, and they had this. So every room was one-touch connected. You just literally hit the keyboard, you're on. You're on your own personal desktop, which I thought was really super cool.
I do like my dual large monitors here at the office. I don't have that at home. That's worth coming in for on its own.
Brian, back to your 5 points there. I thought it's a silver lining in all of this transformation with how we work and the function of workplace and how people attract and retain employees. As you mentioned, you know, law firms typically aren't as progressive in terms of their speed of change, like that which you might see in tech. But the result is, you know, albeit, yes, we're going through a massive shift in how we use space and come to the office, et cetera, the result is positive long-term, I think. And one thing I remind my law firm clients all the time is they're embarking on these long-term leases, like you mentioned, law firms typically do, which we all know they do, is that let's just say you're out with a law firm right now whose lease expires in 2025, 2 years in advance, which is reasonable. And they're going to sign another 10 to 11 year commitment. So that's going to take them out to, say, 2035 or 36 or 37. There are people right now, young men and women, dare I even say men or women, because they are in middle school right now, who will become partners of the law firm that you're representing right now for a 10-year transaction that might not expire until 2035 or 36 or 37. So think about that. Like, how someone's going to work that is in, you know, late middle school, early high school, who will become a partner during the lease term, the next lease term of that law firm, is completely different than someone who is, say, 45, 55, 60 years old. That's the same for someone who might be 30 years old today or 20 years old today. And so I think the best firms are those that are starting to think long-term, especially if they have an aging workforce with a lot of transition about to happen with the firm, with those that are setting, you know, their expectations that they're going to retire in the next few years. How you design space will have a huge impact on how you recruit, because these people coming out of law school in, say, you know, 5 to 10 years are going to look at space a lot differently than that person that might be having occupied space for the last 30 years of their career.
Isn't that scary? Right? It lends itself to say you shouldn't be doing 15-year leases. I know it makes sense for the partners of the firm today, because they get a more favorable, hopefully, economic deal over that period of time because of the term. They're trading, you know, cost for, or they're trading average annual cost for overall cost. But if you are really looking at your firm from the perspective of how do we align our space to our partners, no one has a clue what those people are going to want, right? And the, you know, the landlords are, in a lot of markets, I would tell you, in New York, like, they won't even talk to you if you're a law firm and you want to do less than 10 years. And hopefully that's changing, right? I know it's changing for most industries here in Boston, but maybe the partners at the firms and the legal administrators that are looking at what's our strategy, we don't know how those people are going to work, but we know one thing, it's not going to be the same way as we're working right now, because we're not even working the same way we were 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and we're the same people. Never mind the new people that are coming out of school that are completely different. How AI is going to change it, how technology in general is going to change it, how people who have grown up in the world of post-COVID are going to want to use space is so different than us that had to go through it, and we're still anchored in this old way that we're trying to pull everyone back to at times, and we're nostalgic about it. How about people that never experienced that? What are they going to want? Like, the whole world should get real short, real flexible, and really dynamic, rather than have law firms be the favorable tenant because they want to do 15-year leases and landlords like that, right? So it's interesting.
Yeah, and we all have clients who are those who prefer, like the four of us, to have a private office. But there's a lot of people that I would call like office nomads. They just like to work in a very hybrid fashion. They don't have a set schedule. When they do come to the office, they might grab a private office. They might work in that amenity space you talked about, Brian. They're just a nomadic kind of work style, which works for them. It wouldn't work for me per se. I think it's a matter of taking a step back, solving for a multi-generational workforce, and then also a workforce that, having been through a 3-year pandemic, now works differently and prefers that different manner than they did previously. So lots to unpack here. I mean, it could be a great pod to have a renowned architect on the call to kind of share what they're seeing, but nevertheless, great discussion.
Okay, Brian, so you're making this point of maybe companies shouldn't be signing 15-year leases because of the unknowable things that are going to happen over the next 10 to 15 years. We've made some great points that, Owen saying that some of these future partners of law firms are still in high school, right, that are going to be, occupying, a space that a decision is made for now. But when you think about all of these things, couldn't you make the counter argument of how much will law firm spaces really change in the next 15 years? And maybe they will from a design standpoint, maybe they will from an amenity standpoint. But are you actually taking that big of a risk if you're going into a Class A plus building and you're building a perimeter office or a office dense layout, right? Like, I'm pretty confident that attorneys are going to all be still working in private offices 15 years from now, right? Like, I think that that's something that is fairly predictable. And when you think about the vast majority of cost that goes into a build out, right, it's constructing the walls, soundproofing, things like that. It's not, hey, we need to renovate the kitchen once every 15 years, or we need to change out this type of amenity for another amenity. So I'm curious how you respond to that. Obviously, if you look back 15 years in terms of how law firms were designing space, there have been things that have changed that cannot change again. For example, office sizes have gotten dramatically smaller. Are they going to get any smaller? I'd argue no. Like, you can't really take a, 10 by 12 office and make it, 8 by 10, like desks, and it just won't be functional anymore. So I'm curious if you think there is, a modern day version or a next decade version of shrinking offices, technology integration, things like that, that will actually be different in such a manner that it causes these build outs to be functionally obsolete, where it's more affordable for them to relocate than to renovate their existing space.
Great question. And it's almost like you were asking this question because it's something I wanted to talk about anyway, because here's my opinion of it. they're going to be dramatically different, not in necessarily the build-up. They're still going to need offices, but they're not going to be headquartered in downtown urban markets anymore. There's going to be this hub and spoke model is going to be more prevalent. Lawyers don't work in large teams. They don't work, unless they're working on something together. They don't work. It's a very individual-based industry where you work with either partners and associates and admins, right? And it's a it's an industry where you can break those offices apart, get people's commutes more reasonable, get people's connectivity to their office closer to their homes, to the key bedroom communities around a municipality, rather than force everybody down to a single location. So while I agree with you that you can't really get a 9x9 office or a 9x10 office or a 10x8 office, it's probably not going to get any smaller. They're not all going to be in the same location. And I think that's the biggest wild card in my mind is we don't know where they're going to be. Why are we signing long-term leases to put us in a location? And by the way, even if you still want to be downtown, we don't know what those downtowns are going to look like in 10 years. Do you still want to be in the location in New York City where there's going to be all this residential conversion around you for the next 10 years and you're living in a construction zone? Or what if that residential conversion doesn't come and it's just a ghost town around you? Like, you just don't know right now. And I think there's too much uncertainty in the marketplace to be making these long-term commitments.
And think about, a multi-floor law firm. I mean, you want to talk about team interaction and mixing. Once you're on different floors, you're losing that. So imagine a hub and spoke strategy that says, look, we're not going to go larger than a floor, or those extra floors, we're going to turn those into the spokes. We're going to get those out closer to where our folks live. We're going to dramatically decrease our average commute time. And oh, by the way, what if we get a building? There's still a significant tenant in these spoke. If each one's a full floor, what if we got a building sign on each one of those sites? Now we've got this branding opportunity, and we've got 7 signs up around town where our people live. And instead of one downtown, where we've talked about this so much on the pod, the sort of shifting civic design. But I think that's a really good example of where a multi-floor law firm could adopt that hub and spoke strategy. I think it'd be brilliant.
I'm going to be a contrarian against the two of you and say that I don't like your ideas for a couple of reasons. Number one, this hub and spoke model has not proven to be effective. I've yet to see a company that thinks that that's like the right way to do it, because you're separating your teams that arguably should be together, and that's the reason you want them in the office, right? To be together, and now you're putting, multiple teammates, throughout a region per se, and the likelihood that they ever see their other teammates who they would have otherwise seen in their headquarters is about 1 out of 10, okay? I mean, the reality is they'll never see each other unless they're called into an all-hands meeting. The second thing that I think you're missing is that this is, in many respects across the country, the best time to be a tenant in what has been, a decade or possibly even two, adjusted for inflation. That's not a reason to run out and have every tenant sign a long-term lease. I don't want to let the tail wag the dog. But for those that do have line of sight into their headcount and what they're going to be doing with their workplace, or at least have a division for what they want that workplace to be, the terms that they're going to achieve today, in my opinion, are going to be far better than those they might achieve in 5 years. Because in 5 years, the market will have begun or have already reset. There might be a better equilibrium at that point in time, and terms might not be so good. I would suggest that they're not going to be. And when are you going to be able to achieve the amount of capital that you can achieve today? Capital being tenant improvements, on top of a tremendous amount of free rent, in many cases, a full year on a 10-year lease, at rates that, adjusted for inflation, in some respects are back to where they were, at least in my market, I'd say almost like 2008 recession levels. And so you have to keep that in mind. And again, I'm not suggesting you let the market dictate your workplace strategy, but I have plenty of clients who are taking advantage of what they have today for the sake of not, missing this opportunity. Now, that being said, I'll be the first to say, for those that are high growth, those that don't know what the future looks like, those that are having a really, really hard time getting people back to the office, it would be foolish to go, say, 10 to 12 years on a lease term. But so I'm not suggesting this is a one-size-fits-all scenario. But to Tucker's point, I don't think there's going to be so much monumental change that there's going to be a need to reevaluate your workplace every 5 years, not to mention how disruptive that is to go through that real estate process, because the people that are running these real estate projects for these firms, generally speaking, are not full-time real estate directors. These are attorneys themselves, managing partners, firm administrators. They've got plenty to do beyond work on a real estate project. So is it a good use of their time and commitment too, knowing these projects take, this isn't like a weekend project. This is a year-long project. To have to do every 5 years is quite disruptive.
Well, I think that, Owen, you make a really good point. I don't disagree with you. But if you're staying in your same building, you're likely, if you're of size, say a floor or more, you're likely doing this 2 to 3 years before your lease is up because of the timeline to design and build space. So say it's 2 years. You sign a 7-year lease, you're still 9 years before your expiration, right? On a renewal. Now, if you have to go to a new building, even if you're getting, so in this market, you get $200 a foot, it's probably costing you $3 or $4. So that's still a significant out-of-pocket cost. And on the P&L, obviously, you're putting the entire $400 on the P&L. You likely have to sign a 10-year lease. But if you're doing a renewal, do you really need to go out 13 years if you're doing it 3 years early? That just seems to me like you're just giving the landlord. Plus, by the way, leases now, you know, have annual escalators. So the back end of that, it gets front-loaded on your P&L to a straight-line rent, and the value isn't necessarily there. You might have, and you have to look at this in an analysis, but the value of that upfront savings because of the market could get eroded at the longer your lease term is, because you have to average it out. But if you look at it, say, and do a 7-year lease, right, it could be a better average annual occupancy cost for the firm. So I just say, like, 7 plus 2 is 9. Like, on a renewal, do you really need to go off 13 years?
You're absolutely right. You don't if you are doing a carpet and paint refresh. The TI allowance you're going to get on a 5-year lease is not going to rebuild your space for today's evolving workplace. And as people, again, as we've talked about at nauseating lengths, trying to get people back to the office, a carpet and paint refresh, typically, from what I can see, is not going to achieve the results. Not to mention, space law firms designed, if they're coming out of a 10-year lease, which was really designed 10 years ago, a decade ago, people use space a lot different than they do 10 years prior. So unless you're a law firm that's like, hey, we are in space that's fantastic, carpet and paint works for us, wonderful, totally agree with you, limit the term potentially. But if you're one of those firms that is trying to enhance their workplace and to those five things you talked about earlier on this pod, Brian, the capital allowance provided on a 5-year lease is not going to come even remotely close to funding even 20% of the work required to change the space.
I just want to remind everyone that obviously you are not limited to a tenant improvement allowance when you're remodeling space. For example, if you're going to get $50 a foot, you can spend more than $50 a foot and just write a check. I think the point to highlight here is just generally speaking, most law firms don't want to come out of pocket because it does disrupt partner distributions. And that is very sacred, at least to most law firms. But yeah, like if we're talking more generally, there's 100% scenarios where, and this could include law firms, but certainly is not limited to law firms, probably even more prominent for technology companies and non-law firm type entities, is to sign the 7-year lease or, you know, have it be 9 years total instead of 13 years total, like Brian's talking about, get less capital, but have a more favorable, you know, average occupancy cost, and then just come out of pocket, right? Like, that is an option for people. And it's a company by company, like transaction by transaction type of analysis that needs to be done and decision that needs to be made based on every unique company's specific circumstance. I want to go back to something that Brian was talking about earlier. These offices getting pushed into suburban locations. So with law firms in particular, and I want to know how you think about this, because this could be an interesting education opportunity for me. My impression of this, and I've seen this happen a lot, is that when this happens, you're really just moving the office closer to where the partners live and further away from where the associates live, right? So I'm not sure that like it actually really works. I'm sort of in Owen's camp. And if obviously every city's unique. And of course, there's affordable housing in some parts. Like let's take Los Angeles as an example, right? Like, okay, partners generally are going to live in more expensive areas. There's very few parts of LA where it's inconceivable that a right out of law school person couldn't afford to live. They can't afford a house, but they can afford an apartment or some, you know, smaller square footage type of environment. But if you're really pushing these out into the suburbs, doesn't that defeat the purpose of training and bringing everyone together? I'm with Owen on this. I don't think that actually moving these locations into suburban areas is really creating a net benefit for everyone. I think it's just creating this greater concentration where now we have an office that's convenient for partners. Now we have an office that's convenient for associates. And really what you need is an office that's convenient for everyone to create this environment and this community where the next generation of future attorneys can be trained and brought up and mentored by, you know, the superstars of today. And I just don't think that that happens without a centralized location, at least as well. At least unless you have massive, unusual scale that maybe only a handful of law firms in each market actually have.
And just a quick point that we haven't hit on, like it depends the type of law and the type of law firm. You know, there's a high concentration of law firms in downtown because they need quick and easy access to the courthouse.
Yeah, I think that's why everyone keeps, in my opinion, keeps some sort of a beachhead downtown. But Tucker, you work LA, the poster child for hub and spoke. I think every company I've ever worked with has something in LA and then something in the Valley because it's better for the partners or the senior people, better for the staff, better for everybody to have two locations because it's hard to get around and commute, right? Take that strategy. It could be as simple as two locations. Take that strategy and pick the location outside of every metro area where you could break the office just into two pieces. Would that be better for people? I think by and large, painting a broad brush, it would be better because it's better to get at least closer to more people or some people, but still have the option of working in that urban center where maybe your younger associates or younger staff still live.
I think what you've seen more in LA, in particular for the larger law firms, is that they might have a location in downtown and in Century City. And I think about that as, and having interacted with tons of these law firms, there's rarely that much collaboration that goes on between these offices, like any more so than collaboration would go on between, say, San Diego and LA or LA and Boston or LA and Seattle. They're effectively two separate P&Ls, two separate managing partners. It's very rare that you have these, two integrated firms. And yeah, because traffic in LA is awful and the time to get from downtown to Century City, depending on traffic, could be an hour, even though it's like 7 miles, right? It's effectively no different than having an office in Orange County for a lot of these firms. I would argue that that's not actually the, hey, let's push these out to the suburbs. It's more just, hey, we can access different talent by having a location here, and we're a large national firm with 50 locations, and we have one in downtown. Why can't we have one on the west side? Which would be the same as, hey, we have an office in LA. Why don't we have an office in Orange County? Why don't we have an office in San Diego? It's another dot on the map where they can bring in, you know, great attorneys that otherwise they might not be able to have access to. That's how I think most of these firms in LA actually look at this, versus like, hey, we got to push these locations out closer to where people live.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but I think as the world changes, that becomes more prevalent to think that way, right? It's about attracting new talent, retaining talent, getting offices in more locations. And maybe it is. Maybe they are separate OMPs. Maybe they are separate P&Ls. But it's more of a strategy to be where our people are or want to be rather than forcing everybody downtown. Right? That's really what they did. They said, our people are here. Why don't we open an office here? Rather than our people are there, they still have to come downtown. I don't know. So, the other part of this that's interesting, and I want you guys to take, sorry, John, I'll let you jump in a second, is knowing this, right? And having this information around that that law firms are landlords' preferred tenants. Landlords believe law firms will renew and sign long-term leases. Or if a law firm moves into their building, they will sign a long-term lease. What does this mean if you're representing other tenants in that building or that landlord's portfolio? How do you leverage this? How do you time your enter into the market ahead of a law firm or after a law firm renews, right? So there's a strategy for this information for every other tenant that's impacted by the law firm's strategy, because you're not the favored tenant in the building, that law firm is. And it's good to be aware of it. It's good to build a strategy around it. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer. But if your lease is up in the same year as a major law firm or major tenant law firm, not a major law firm, but just a tenant that's a major sized tenant in the building, how do you play that? And my answer is that you don't want the landlord to have completed the renewal for the law firm doing a longer term lease at a higher rent, hopefully before you do your lease, right? You want both tenants in play. You want the uncertainty of that firm having not committed to the building yet. So it's just important to understand. You don't want to see what happens because they're likely going to pay higher rent and they're going to sign a longer term lease than you want to. So it's just a good reminder as you look at your portfolio for the real estate directors out there. If you're going to be competing with a law firm in a building in terms of timing and strategy and execution of a new lease, know what the landlord's view of the marketplace is and how you time your enter into the market and how you time your ultimate final deal terms and when you execute.
Okay, if I'm a tenant in a building and there's a giant law firm that, say, occupies 20% of the building and there's a renewal coming up, I think the counter argument, Brian, would be, couldn't that already be priced in? If these landlords are already so confident that these law firms are going to stay on really long-term leases and at really high rates, do you think that landlords have already priced it in? And this is a bit of a rhetorical question because I agree, all things being equal, negotiating a lease ahead of 20 or 30 or 40 or 50% of the building having a risk of rolling over is, of course, more favorable. I just would caution people to not let someone else's expiration date dictate your strategy. But if you can sync it up into your strategy, then great.
The answer is you need to be aware of it and understand it so you can build it into your strategy. I don't think it ever changes what you want to do, how you do it. But if you have the same expiration date or year, build it into your strategy, knowing what the expectations are for them. Because if you can complete the process ahead of that firm, then I think you're in a better place.
If you could represent the law firm and that other tenant, now you've got visibility to both. Go get that law firm as a client.
But John, not all of us can represent everybody like you do down in San Diego.
A word of caution, I guess, based off of the study we were talking about earlier. Anyone that is trying to say, okay, I'm going to combine my tenancy with this law firm, we're going to negotiate with this collective bargaining power, what you may inadvertently end up doing is just negotiating yourself a bad deal because all these law firms are overpaying on rent and signing longer term leases than everyone else, at least according to the data. So I want to make one more point and then we'll go to John to segue to who knows what, probably something cool. But before we go there, this idea of signing long-term leases, we touched briefly on, hey, there's things that aren't going to change as much as what's changed in the last 10 to 15 years, like office sizes going down, offices can't get smaller as we've talked about. I think the biggest thing that people need to be really cognizant of if they're signing a 10 or 15 year lease is how is the geographical area surrounding their building going to change in the meantime? There have been so many instances where in 2019, we've had clients that sign leases in really cool, trendy parts of town that everyone is sort of moving to. Owen and I had a transaction for one of the companies that I handle real estate for globally in Seattle, moved into this really cool, creative like tech community, right on the sort of edge of the downtown CBD of Seattle called Pioneer Square. And during COVID, this place became like an open air drug market. I mean, it was like really sad, just crazy, like to the point where you can't have people walking their cars at night without like armed security or they're nervous. But what an awful situation, right? And of course, this was in 2019 when these leases were signed, where who would have thought we'd have a global pandemic? But people need to keep in mind that downtowns are changing. There is this death spiral that's happening in certain areas. And that I would argue that that's the bigger risk. It's not, hey, is this class A plus building from a like quality of real estate, not from location? Is this building going to suck? Like, it's probably like a pretty low probability if there's really high quality tenants in there on long-term leases. Is the space that you're building going to be non-functional in 10 years if you're a law firm? Probably not if you design it thoughtfully with great architects and designers. But but is the actual neighborhood that people are driving into, as far as, you know, retail vibrancy, crime, safety, all of these things, could that change? 100%. And people need to be really focused on trying to mitigate that through their real estate selection process.
Okay, now you got me going back to law firms. So let me correct something. I don't think the data shows that law firms are signing bad leases. I think the data shows that law firms on average are signing longer leases and paying higher rental rates. And I believe that's largely driven by the cost of the improvements in a typical law firm build out. It's not about them signing bad deals. I'm sure they're smart. I'm sure they're the only other thing I would say it contributes to it in the quality price matrix. You know, quality is a really high priority for most law firms. So they're not just out looking to get the best deal. They're looking for high quality space, and they're seeking large capital contributions from the landlord, which drives up the need for a longer term and ultimately a slightly higher rental rate. But the data doesn't show they're signing bad deals. The data is reflecting the quality of the spaces they're getting and the cost to deliver those spaces.
John, try to tell an office managing partner that his net effective rent is the highest in the building and tell him that wasn't a bad deal. I think he might have a different opinion than you, because on the effective side, you are putting in all the concessions to get that rent. And if their rent is higher than other tenants in the building and their lease is longer, it should be the lowest, because they've committed to more years of rent for that building. So it's not a bad deal, maybe. There's always nuance, but it's not a good deal.
I wonder if there's a way to go in the back end of this podcast, manipulate John saying that law firms get bad deals, imply that he thinks all law firms are bad negotiators, and then, you know, post that on LinkedIn or something. But no, yeah, to clarify, this is not because of some, you know, like incompetency or something by any means of law firms. It is largely because of the nature of their structure. But there's another piece of this that is just as important, and it's the perception by landlords. Right, the perception by landlords is that these people are not going to move, or that they can't move. And that's, I would say, more insidious even than the deal structure. Law firms get worse deals generally because they're in a worse position to negotiate than someone else. Right, if you're a technology company right now and you have a lease expiring a year from now and you're in 50,000 feet and you're in any, you know, major CBD, you can go to the landlord and be like, what are we even talking about here renewing? I can go to a dozen move-in ready subleases at 50% less than market with high, you know, credit sublandlords. Why would we stay here when I can save half, right? And you don't have that same option as a law firm. I mean, surprisingly, there's very few high quality legal subleases that are available across the US. I mean, of course there's some, but there's very few of them. So there's two components, and, you know, I would say that obviously there's a lot of variance within any different sector of company that we represent. But generally speaking, I think the level of sophistication, level of negotiation, understanding, and skill from law firms is very high. And that's not why they're paying the highest rents by any means, just to clarify.
And make sure, too, that you're quantifying landlords' downside risk. Like some of these law firms that I've moved over the past 2 years, the space they've left is space that was literally 10, 15, sometimes 20 years old, and has almost zero residual value for the landlord. And so landlords need to recognize, like, what they're going to get back if they lose that tenant is going to cost an absolute fortune just to get it into a condition where when a tenant tours it, they're even somewhat inspired about possibly moving to that space. Because the condition that they will be left in once the tenant moves out is going to feel like you're walking into your grandfather's law firm, and you're going to be like, I can never envision my team here. So what landlords often do is they go in and demolish all of the improvements, knowing that someone's going to do it anyway, and white box the space, meaning just white walls and a concrete floor. That can cost upwards of $25 a square foot, especially if it's a dense law firm build. And that's just to get back to like ground zero. So something that's like, we have to understand and is incumbent upon anyone representing a law firm is help substantiate landlord's next best alternative, just like the tenant has their own next best alternative. And finally, I want to make an earlier point too. Obviously, these rents that we're talking about affect partner distributions, which is very sacred for a law firm. But also, what keeps firm administrators up at night amongst, you know, obviously many things, is that what if their top three competitors in the market recast their leases in a market that is very inexpensive relative to where everybody once was, and that next tenant doesn't expire for a few years. There's concern that what if my, you know, three biggest competitors are paying 30-40% less rent than I am? It's going to either affect A, distributions to the partners, or B, it's going to affect what we can comp new attorneys and what we can pay on recruitment. So it's really important too, I think, at least from the law firms I work with, looking at their peers and their competitors as to what they're doing, not in terms of we want to follow their workplace strategy or necessarily their real estate deals, but are they taking advantage of the market? And are we going to be the one firm potentially that misses out on this opportunity to cast an amazing lease term and therefore be competitive with our spend or distributions, which affect recruitment and retainment?
Well, you're saying that you're bringing up a really important point, and more broadly, not just law firms. You know, often when a tenant is sitting in a space that's highly improved, highly specialized, they can be seen as captive. It would be hard to go and replicate that. And that's true, except it's always true on the flip side as well. When that tenant does move, because the build out is highly specialized, it's almost entirely going to be a gut and redo. So to the extent that the tenant has a burden of a cost of relocation, the landlord has an equivalent burden of a full, maybe even a bigger burden, because they're going to have to carry the space for some period of time. They're going to have to pick up all the operating expenses while there's nobody there to help pay those. And then they're going to have to do a major full renovation because of the highly specialized nature of those improvements. So don't let highly specialized improvements lead you to believe that you're captive in a negotiation on a renewal.
I want to go back to what Tucker said earlier about location, because this is so important, and it reminded me of an article I saw over the weekend, right? So you're signing this long-term lease, and what is the neighborhood in the surroundings of the building that you're leasing in? Now, you looked at it from the perspective of blight, but the other piece of this, which is equally, I think, important right now, is what's the development community around you selling as the dream of this new neighborhood, of this new place, right? Because a lot of that dream and vision in reality today, it cannot get financed, doesn't have tenants, and won't get built. So your landlord or your location may be an okay location, fine. It's not going to be a crime or a blight issue. But is it really going to be the vision that the landlord or that developer or other developers are selling? Because the realities of the marketplace today are not affording them the ability to go forward with projects, right? So the article I want to reference is Brookfield. So they bought many years ago, like in 2018, They spent billions to buy mall owner GGP, and they bought 125 malls. And their whole plan was to turn these malls into mini cities, really redevelop them into office, retail, and residential. Well, in 6 years, they've done two projects. One of them, Owen, in your backyard, and the other one, I think, down in Phoenix, if I'm off the top of my head. No, Atlanta. It was in Atlanta. But the strategy was to create this huge new vision, huge new live, work, play environment, and it just has failed. And they have come out and said that, no, we've done redevelopments in 40 of those malls, and we've brought new life to some of those malls. We brought new residential, new office to some of those malls. Well, if they're incomplete projects, I feel for the tenants that were the first ones in those projects, because now they're sitting around an old enclosed mall, and in Brookfield's mind, it's done, but that tenant might have been sold a vision that was very different than what ultimately happened. And I've seen that around the country for many years, and I think it's very prevalent now, is that you want to be the first one in because you get the best deal, you get in on the ground floor, you get to pick a lot of, you get a lot of selectivity around what it becomes, but the rest of the vision never gets there because they can't do the leasing or they can't get the financing to make the project happen.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. I mean, for those that don't know Brookfield, I mean, they're one of the world's largest commercial property investors. And Brookfield Property Partners, who Brian is referring to, is a subsidiary of Brookfield Asset Management. So massive, massive company here, making a huge, $9.25 billion bet during the pandemic that these malls that were thought to be kind of obsolete or, better turn into something else. They saw that opportunity to transform them into these mini cities, they called it, which was, resi, office, and hotel, and, retail. The real challenge here, Brian mentioned they did two projects, Atlanta and Seattle. They've got some stuff going on in North Carolina and Denver, but the redevelopment has been super slow. And that's been due to high costs that they didn't anticipate, lengthy city approvals, because you're rezoning these projects from something that was to something that is going to be something completely different. And and sometimes community pushback. I read articles that sometimes in some of these places where they bought, these 125 malls, communities are like, no, we don't want that here. That's not what we're, that's not highest and best use for the vision for the community. So they've got a lot of community pushback in certain places. And the challenges here is that, you've got also these existing tenant agreements in some of these projects. They're not 100% vacant, keep in mind. There are malls that are, still in some cases partially occupied, especially with big department stores. And that has really complicated redevelopment efforts. And so this whole notion that they had a great thesis, I'll give them credit. Like during the pandemic, this all sounded great, but it's become really, really hard. And, with the rising costs, and especially shifting consumer habits, with the continual rise of online shopping has really decreased these values of these particularly lower tier properties, which some of these were. And so it remains to be seen what happens. I mean, they've since sold or handed back 24 of those malls to the lenders, and there's rumor that they may sell 16 more. So clearly they're not long on, every property they bought. But, this article that Brian was referring to was in the Wall Street Journal. They're still, the executives, of course, are emphasizing that they do take time. These adaptations, changing market conditions will require that this execution takes longer than it once thought it would be. But they're still committed to doing this and making it financially viable for their investors. But really interesting article. And I do know the mall here in Seattle. And for those that are listening here in the Pacific Northwest, it's the Alderwood Mall, where if you drive up there right now in Lynnwood, you see a massive, massive apartment project next to the mall. And that seems to be one of their more higher performing assets that seems to be doing pretty well. That did not get a lot of community pushback. It seems to be doing well, but that's an example for those in the Northwest if you want to see firsthand what we're talking about.
So this mini city strategy and the acquisition happened in 2018, just so everyone knows. So this was a, prior to COVID type of bet that they made. I think that basically anyone would have had a higher level of aggressiveness around pursuing a strategy like this in 2018. This is not the type of, $9-something billion acquisition that I expect Brookfield would have made in 2020 had they known how, the cards were going to lay out here. And then the other thing is that it's hard to emphasize and strongly enough just how difficult it is to do development right now, particularly for office assets. I mean, it is really, really challenging. And the biggest challenge is that when you're building a new construction office building, even if it's a 10 or 15 year lease build to suit, the big challenge is that basically every developer and every lender wants to make sure that the rental rate that the company is paying as part of that lease is not dramatically higher than market, right? Otherwise, the underlying real estate is going to be valued improperly, and you may as well be buying a bond or something, right? And you start thinking about some of these markets where the nicest Class A plus office buildings might lease for, let's just use easy numbers, they might lease for $4 or $5 per square foot per month. But to actually deliver a Class A plus new construction building today might be $8 a square foot. It's extremely challenging to get that building built. No developer wants to take the risk of having such a high basis in their property that they're never going to be able to get their money out, or knowing that at the end of a 15-year lease, once that rent is gone, if that tenant leaves, or even if that tenant renews, that they're never going to be able to get a rent that is that high ever again. And this makes the problem even worse, because then developers go, okay, if I don't have credit risk, then I need to make sure that I'm getting the vast majority of my investment back so I can think of my basis after this lease expiring as way lower, which pushes the rent up even higher. And then you have these office rents that are, you know, twice what they are to go to the next comparable office building in the market. And that simply doesn't work.
And that's that was my point earlier around, you have to really be aware of what's around you and make sure when you're making a bet on a emerging location that you really do the homework on what else is coming, because right now it is an extremely challenging market to be able to deliver. And it's not just office, though. That math that you're doing is consistent across other product types too. Hotels, residential are really getting challenged with the underwriting in the short term, at least on those asset classes. So it's important to be aware of it and not allow the developer to sell you a dream that may not come to fruition during your lease term.
Yeah. The last point before we wrap up, and Brian, of course, knows this because we were working on deals like this together right now. I think the key difference just for our listeners between doing an office development right now or doing an apartment development right now is that the lender community and development community generally feel that multifamily 15 years from now, of course, is going to exist. People are always going to need places to live, right? And I think that there's some fear on the development side of, if you're doing adding more office product, are you actually delivering something that there's going to be a need for in 15 years? And I think that's the key difference is, over a 15-year period, you can grow into these above market rents for a premium type of product. But on an office building, can you grow into it? A lot of people are thinking probably not. So anyways, we'll wrap up there. That's all the time we got. Thanks for listening to episode 38, and we'll be back again in another 2 weeks.